Aloha, welcome to The Conversation. I'm Bill Dorman, in today for Catherine Cruz. We've seen brush fires pop up on two islands this week. This morning, we'll hear about wildfire prevention efforts on Kauai. There are some changes, a new plan, even a device called Thor's Hammer. We'll explain. We check in on the state of small business in Hawaii, a perspective from the state's largest craft brewer. The CEO has some thoughts for local policymakers. We swing by the chambers of the Hawaii State Supreme Court as the Chief Justice prepares for mandatory retirement. On today's Manu Minute, we listen to the calls of a bird that makes a cameo appearance in the Kumulipo. Plus, Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys will share part of an interview he called one of his all-time favorites. Aloha. You're tuned to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman, in this morning for Catherine Cruz. Brush fires have already burned on at least two islands this week, on Maui and Oahu. As we move through this summer, concern about fires is high on all islands. Hawaiian Electric made some sweeping changes after the 2023 Maui wildfires. You may have gone through some public safety power shutoffs launched by HECO last year. On Kauai, electricity is run by its utility cooperative, and they have a new plan to deal with the increasing risk of wildfires. Here to talk about that this morning is HPR's climate and energy reporter, Savannah Harriman-Pote. Good morning, Sav.
Good morning, Bill.
And we are starting off with new plans from Kauai.
Yes, so the Kauai Island Utility Cooperative has submitted a wildfire mitigation plan similar to the process that HECO is going through in front of the Public Utilities Commission. And it lays out the KIUC's strategy for reducing wildfire risk as well as the associated costs over the next 3 years. And there is a lot in this plan, so I reached out to Beth Amaro, who is the Communications and Member Services Manager at KIUC, to get some of the key details that listeners need to know about the work the utility is doing.
And from what you've been reporting on this, it sounds like the starting point is the electrical grid itself.
Yeah, so there's a process called grid hardening that's a big focus, and listeners may be familiar with that term. That's about making the utility's physical infrastructure more resilient against things like storms, high winds, and, of course, wildfires. And that work takes a ton of resources. So, for instance, we know a single down utility pole can be a significant hazard. It can also cause inconvenient power outages. KIUC has more than 16,000 utility poles throughout its service areas, and it's currently assessing all of its wood poles at a rate of about 2,000 per year. And this is kind of a neat thing that Amaro told me about. They're using this technology called Thor's Hammer, which does indeed look like a hammer, to test wood poles for decay.
You just tap the bottom of the pole, and it has sensors that go up the length of the pole. It will give out a reading of the general health of the pole and give us a good indicator of when that pole needs to be replaced. We're testing thousands of poles, you know, each year, and we're finding about a 6% failure rate. So about 6% of the poles that we're testing need to be replaced.
Thor's Hammer sounds fine, but boy, 6% of all utility poles? That sounds like a pretty high number. How quickly do they think they're going to be able to get to this?
So Amaro says that any damaged poles are going in a queue. They're being replaced as a matter of urgency, but the utility is going to prioritize poles that have extensive decay or that support certain types of critical equipment like transformers.
You know, we hear a lot with wildfires around the country and in Hawaii about utilities putting power lines underground, but that is always such an expensive proposition. Is this going to be part of the strategy for Kauai?
Yeah, so that practice is called undergrounding, understandably, and several utilities in the western United States have done it. Hawaiian Electric is thinking about doing it in specific places. And while it can make sense as a fire prevention measure, it is very costly when you compare it to the cost of overhead lines, those lines we see attached to utility poles. Amaro estimated that about 30% of their lines are already underground, but to put everything underground, to bury the rest of their lines, that would cost the utility up to $6 billion. And that's just not in the budget, she said. But they are considering burying specific lines, likely the ones that are in areas with dense vegetation that are very hard to get to and maintain.
You know, that idea of vegetation that you mentioned, management of vegetation, we saw this on Maui, we've seen this other places, that is such a critical part. Big Island, lots of focus on that as well. For Kauai, what's the plan on that area?
So Amaro said that KIUC has seriously ramped up its vegetation management efforts, and the utility is expecting to spend about $3 million on vegetation management in 2025, which is triple what they historically have budgeted for that work if you look at, to 2023 and before. And in addition to removing dry and overgrown vegetation below the power line, so if a line falls, it might spark that vegetation and start a fire, KIUC is also targeting hazardous trees for removal. And damage to KIUC's infrastructure from falling trees and tree limbs is currently responsible for about a third of the power outages on Kauai, so this is a significant hazard. But Amaro said that long-term effective vegetation management requires collaboration from the utility, the state, the county, and private landowners. So they're working to get all of those lines of communication open.
Yeah, that collaboration step is another thing that we're seeing statewide of just all of those parties that you mentioned in different locations. But boy, some of these things that you mentioned, the pole replacements, the undergrounding of some wires, the management of the vegetation, this is very expensive just in terms of the approach. Does the Kauai Island Utility Cooperative have an estimate on spending for this?
Yeah, so there are a lot of numbers in the wildfire mitigation plan that listeners can find if they're interested at hawaiipublicradio.org. But Amaro said, adding that all up, it may take as much as $50 million over the next 3 years to fully implement KIUC's wildfire mitigation strategy. And KIUC gets its revenue by charging customers. So they currently don't have an estimate on how customers' bills may increase for the cost of the utility's wildfire mitigation work. That's something that they need to work out before the Public Utilities Commission. But it's worth noting that lawmakers passed a measure this year that makes it easier for electric cooperatives like KIUC to recover costs for wildfire prevention work from ratepayers, basically an expedited process for them to recoup some of those expenses. And KIUC has tried to get some federal funding for this work from the U.S. Department of Energy's Grid Resilience and Innovations Partnership, or GRIPS, a program, as well as from FEMA.
We haven't been successful yet, but as far as I know, those were the two main avenues for funding for this type of work. Hopefully there will be more opportunities. We know that the GRIP program was funded by the Infrastructure Act under the Biden administration. There was to be a third round of grants given, and that has been suspended. We don't know whether or not that third round will ever happen, but if it does, we certainly will be looking to that funding source for some relief, some grant funds to help pay for this.
You know, like with so much else, the federal funding question, federal funding that had been budgeted, had been expected, and now has evaporated in some form or another, looking for replacements. At this point, anything else that listeners should know about?
Yeah, absolutely. So actually this week, Kauai stakeholders are launching a wildfire and drought awareness campaign. Hawaii Public Radio is going to bring more coverage on that. But that's because we're getting into the driest and hottest part of the year. And as part of the utility's protocols for wildfire prevention, it could cut the power to customers in the case of a wildfire or the high risk of a wildfire. So its protocols are very similar to Hawaiian Electric's Power Safety Public Safety Power Shutoff Program. It's a little bit of a mouthful of an acronym, for preemptively de-energizing its lines. KIUC calls its program Power Isolation. And Amaro said KIUC will try to notify customers in advance if they're going to cut the power, but that may not be feasible if dangerous weather conditions arise quickly. So it's really important for people to be prepared. They will send out mass text notifications as well as notifications over phone calls and emails. And they're working with Kauai County's Agency on Elderly Affairs to specifically prepare seniors who may have mobility issues or who require electricity for medical equipment, but they want customers to reach out to them in advance if they have that kind of special medical equipment that requires power so they can
that
be aware
sense.
and try to give people that notice. There's a form available at hawaiipublicradio.org with that information.
Thanks, Av. I know you're going to be staying with us, and thanks for your reporting on this.
Thank you, Bill.
Been talking with Savannah Harriman-Pote, our energy reporter, about Kauai Island Utility Cooperative's wildfire mitigation plan. You can find her story at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
In the coming days, the U.S. Senate is expected to vote on a measure to defund public media. Attempts have been made in the past, but none have gotten this far. If Congress approves these cuts, it would eliminate $525,000 in vital funding for HPR. This is Valerie Yee. Help secure the future of Hawaii Public Radio and become a sustaining member. Go to hawaiipublicradio.org/protect.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, opening June 21st, Mary Cassatt at Work. Paintings, pastels, and prints reveal how the Impressionists transformed the course of modern art. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Living with uncertainty, it's something we're all doing these days. For business leaders in Hawaii, and especially business owners, that means planning and leading despite uncertainty. Garrett Marrera knows that. He's CEO and co-founder of Maui Brewing Company. His business touches on everything from local manufacturing and national distribution to restaurants, supply chains, even tourism. Maui Brewing is also celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. This week, we spoke with Garrett about change, challenges, and the state of small business in Hawaii. We started with a quick look back at his company's growth over the years.
So I guess we're not really surprised, but it is when you look back, you're like, wow, 20 years already has gone by. And yeah, it's been quite a journey, that's for sure.
I wanted to start off by playing you two quick sound clips. They're both from past interviews that you and I have had on The Conversation. The first is from 2012, and it's immediately followed by one from 2017. And we start with you talking about Hawaii and the opportunity you saw for local craft beer.
You learn a lot about a culture through its food and through its drink, and I always like to develop a relationship that way. So I saw a little niche for, you know, making great quality beer locally. Sure enough, here we are, you know, 7.5, almost 8 years later. A little over 20,000 barrels we'll do this year, and just keeps growing.
And you chuckled on that because you've just kept growing. You're at about double that.
Level. Yeah, 2.5 times almost. We'll do about 53,000 barrels this year in the state of Hawaii.
So 53,000 barrels in 2017. What's the outlook for 2025?
It's a smile hearing those sound bites because it definitely reminds me of the history, and it's a good thing to hear because sometimes you need that reminder where you were, and then helps you process where you're at. Yeah, I think this year we'll close out somewhere around 85,000 barrels. That's between the state of Hawaii and our mainland distribution as well. So yeah, still continue to grow. And, you know, we're one of the few brands in the category that's still growing. And I think that speaks to not only the power of the brand, but then the quality of the beverage and the innovation that our team has put together to really have multiple streams of beverage that we're producing. Because even back in 2012 and actually in 2017, we only made beer. There was no other than beer categories for us outside of, say, root beer. And that's dramatically changed over the years.
So you are now, you're the largest craft brewery in the state of Hawaii. You have operations across the island, some 600 employees, I believe.
Right about, yeah.
So how is business, and what's your biggest challenge right now?
Yeah, I think, the biggest challenge, I mean, I think many business owners here in Hawaii are feeling the same thing, with few exception, is that just the last 5 years have been just a constant beatdown. From the way we had the very long pandemic here and the way that was handled and how that hurt our economy. And then fast forward to just a couple, 3 years-ish later to the fires here on Maui, just was it was a gut punch. And, you know, you're looking at, I think the latest Maui numbers, tourism's off about 20% from the pre-COVID levels. And that certainly filters down through every level of what we do, both on the retail side at our restaurants, but then also with other restaurants and bars and hotels serving our beverages. So we feel it on all wholesale and retail fronts. Tariffs are a concern, of course. We're not seeing the significant increases that I think were proposed, which is good so far. I think we will see some hits to price, you know, that eventually at some point that has to get passed down. But my hope is that the tariffs are much more of a negotiating tool than a long-term implementation, and certainly at the levels that they're at right now.
It does kind of leave you a little bit of planning for uncertainty. I mean, the country by country is one thing, but on the commodity front, aluminum very specifically, because that plays into you for cans and not just for beer, but for other beverages as well. How much is that going to affect you?
You know, it's certainly going to drive the cost up for us to produce, but a 50% tariff is a lot worse than a 25% tariff. And we're talking about raw aluminum, but we're also talking about stainless steel and steel for kegs, the cost to replace a keg when it goes missing. If you need to buy new tanks, that drives the cost up for those tanks. And even if that tank is made in America, you're still paying for higher cost of the actual good. So our cans are made right here in Hawaii over in Oahu, the can bodies themselves. But then they're shipped over to us for filling and seaming here on Maui. But that aluminum largely comes from outside the U.S., and so the cost for the can goes up. You know, and it's not going to be directly a 50% increase in the cost of the cans, but, you know, every few pennies matters. And when you think about 24 cans in the case, even say a 50-cent increase in the case price leads to about a $1.50 increase by the time it hits the consumer. So it does make a difference. You know, I think backing up too a little bit, one of the things that scares me the most right now, well, I wouldn't say scare, it certainly worries me, is the labor market here in Hawaii. I think especially after the fires, it only exacerbated an already thin labor pool that we had. And that's certainly concerning because, you know, we're in a very labor capital intensive business. So both on the restaurant side as well as on the production side. So, you know, those are the pieces of the puzzle that are still figuring out.
On labor, I was going to ask you about that, about employment, not just hiring, but also retention. Over time, what do you find is helpful that is within your power as still a small business person? What is within your power to help on that front?
Sure. Well, certainly retention is hugely important because the cost to onboard a teammate and then to train and once they really get productive and can operate, and speaking on the manufacturing side especially, that's a longer ramp up than, say, someone who's never been a busser, a server, or a cook, right? Those generally the training is a little faster. And I think on the restaurant side, you know, we're generally used to pretty transient labor. Everybody that runs a restaurant or a bar in Hawaii knows what that's like. We do have in our upper levels in our management and such, certainly some good staying power. We have lost some due to whether it be housing that was lost in the fire and had to move to the mainland or elsewhere, or a family member job position was eliminated, or those types of things that happened here, or couldn't find work in their chosen field. So then the entire family moves. So it's been unfortunate, but you know, our team always continues to step up and we're very resilient in that way. I think what I'm hearing in the market just from other business owners, and I think I echo the sentiment, is just a lot of us are just kind of sick of having to just survive again. You know, we're blessed with good growth and we've got solid foundation, but it's just that grind. It definitely feels much more of a grind than it has in a long time. And so I think it's just it's that phase that we're in, and it's cyclical. I mean, if you were to talk to anybody back in 2008, in the Great Recession, there was a lot of fear in the market at that point as well. And then look, we had the best decade post Great Recession that we could have expected. I think this is just cyclical. This too shall pass, as my mom likes to remind me sometimes, but it's certainly, it's just challenging times. And I think we're going to be in unfortunately, I don't think everybody's going to survive. I think it's very obvious to me, at least, that the herd is going to get thinned a little bit. And I wouldn't argue that that's not a good thing. I think it kind of has to every now and again for the greater good and for the health of the herd, sometimes has to be thinned.
Maui Brewing CEO Garrett Marrero. We'll be back with more of our conversation about the challenges small businesses in Hawaii face right now. And we'll hear some advice he has for local government leaders. Welcome back to the conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman, and today for Catherine Cruz. We pick up our discussion with Maui Brewing CEO Garrett Marrero about some of the issues currently facing small businesses in Hawaii. Energy costs are one challenge for all businesses. And in Hawaii, to begin with, many of those costs are structurally higher than elsewhere. For Maui Brewing, that includes energy costs of shipping their product.
Shipping is enormously expensive. It's actually cheaper than it was during COVID, at least, but it's still a big part of what we do. I mean, it's for a brewery of our size, you're spending seven figures a year on shipping. If we were the same size brewery in the mainland, you're spending 20% of that, so 80% less. So you're talking about a very difficult place to actually do what we do. I think that kind of speaks to the state and perhaps what the legislature can do to help support small businesses a little bit better. I don't think we do enough. You talk about insurance. Look at what has happened to insurance rates. I mean, I think we've seen 8 to 10-fold increases in insurance is not uncommon in these HOAs and the associations that are managing condos and such. So you're seeing significant costs that should be better controlled. And then you have a high cost of living because of the high tax rates we have here and the high everything. So it's multiple levels that those rates get applied to. And so by the end of the day, you're just like, well, when is the government going to trim its spending? When is the government going to maybe manage funds a little bit better so we don't just have to layer on another fee on top of whether it be tourists or residents? That's something that needs to be considered because, more friendly business environments, those economies seem to be doing better than we are at the moment.
Related to that, Hawaii has some of the highest taxes on beer in the country. I know you know that very well. But my colleague, Maddie Bender, found a piece from the Tax Foundation that shows Hawaii taxes beer at a rate of 93 cents a gallon, which is third. Alaska is second. Tennessee is on top. But the third highest tax rate in the nation for that. While meanwhile, Wyoming, Missouri, and Wisconsin, that's like 2 to 7 cents a gallon. That's a big difference.
Yeah, interestingly, yeah. So Wyoming actually eliminated their tax on the alcohol this past session because they said, look, we're at 2 cents. It cost us more to administer the program than we rake in on it. So we're just going to get rid of it. And that's like sanity. That's just business saying, rather than say, hey, let's up the taxes so that we can pay for this program and then make money, the state already runs well. And then talk about Wyoming, that's a model for, many ways from a tax structure, low sales tax, low property tax, low alcohol tax, low utilities. Now they have to make their money elsewhere, and that's largely through minerals and the natural resources of Wyoming, but also very heavily focused on tourism. You go to Jackson Hole, and it's basically Maui with mountains that are covered in snow in the winter. You have a very high cost of living. Everybody has to commute. There's all of these pieces that just remind me so much of Maui. But you've got a state that's focused on supporting those small businesses and actually is developing workforce housing, not just talking about it. Not that they do it perfectly, but, they're doing it. But, you you were correct. We are number three, but we're really actually number two. Alaska has something that they've done, which I've been proposing for decades now, it feels like, but certainly years, at least the better part of a decade, where they have a high rate and a low rate. And we are third if you apply their high rate to the brewers across the board. But small brewers qualify for the low rate, and that is to support the smaller businesses. And, you know, we're talking obviously not Budweiser, we're talking about us and the low rate. So Hawaii is actually the number two highest tax on alcohol, $2.09 a case. And every year they try to raise it, and it's like, but where's the money going? And fortunately, we've been able to stave off those increases. But that $2 a case adds $6 a case at least to the cost by the time it gets to the customer. And it absolutely hurts the small businesses compared to, of course, the big ones. So that is an area that could change if we had some legislation that was more focused on a small producer level as opposed to just grouping us all into one category.
Gary, you've helped develop certainly craft brewing industry here in Hawaii, and you haven't been shy about sharing thoughts for legislative or executive action that could help. If there would be one thing that you could do now, what would you want done?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the taxes, because that would be something that I would focus on. I mean, I think a small producer bill that incorporates different tax structures based on size of the company, you know, does not create, you know, a disparity between, say, in beer, draft, and package, right? So you have a keg, the taxes are about 60% of what they are for a can. Wine, spirits, none of that has that differential. So based on the way it's served or consumed, we're paying a different tax rate. So there really is a disincentive to packaging, you know, where the focus is basically the lower tax rate would be draft. So I think getting rid of that disparity for the small brewers, and then also creating a tax structure that better recognizes what the state of the industry is, again, not just beer, but in that beer category, we have seltzer, we have things like Mike's Hard Lemonade, for example, which is considered what they call an FMB or an FSB in the case of seltzer in some cases, versus, you know, where you have wine, whatever, however it's sold, it's taxed at the same rate. Spirits, however it's sold, taxed at the same rate. So I would think about how do we support those who are investing in our community, who are employing our neighbors, and build that bill.
Any other thoughts you want to share today?
I'm always bullish on Hawaii. I believe in the state, and I believe in the power of what we have here. You know, you take a step outside and, you know, look at the beautiful state that we have and the people here. I think we'll be okay. It's just don't let the fear take over and, you know, try to stay positive. But, you know, mom has good advice. This too shall pass.
Garrett Marrero, co-founder and CEO of Maui Brewing Company. Thanks for joining us today, Garrett. Aloha.
Aloha. Always nice talking, Bill.
Garrett Marrero, CEO, co-founder of Maui Brewing Company.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Renewable Energy Services, based in Honoka'a on the Big Island, serving the community's solar energy needs since 1992.
Looking for cool, unique experiences and events happening across our Hawaiian Islands? Let your new HPR besties show you the way. Introducing HPR's Social Club newsletter. Every Wednesday, get the latest happenings straight to your inbox. Sign up at hawaiipublicradio.org/socialclub.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
Hawaii Supreme Court Chief Justice Mark Rechtenwald will formally hang up his robes in September after 15 years in that role. He faces mandatory retirement as he turns 70. A bill to increase the age limit for judges did not make it through the legislative session this year, but the session was otherwise a successful one for the judiciary. Lawmakers passed measures to increase judges' compensation, add seats for judges in rural Oahu and West Hawaii, and divert low-level criminal offenders to social service programs instead of to prisons. HPR's government reporter Ashley Mizuo spoke with Chief Justice Rechtenwald about these judicial wins.
It was a really successful year for the judiciary at the legislature. You know, you were able to get many of the items in your legislative package passed. What made this year different?
Well, to me, I think the biggest thing is that we've had a number of areas where we've been working over the years on very significant problems in our community. So one is issues around homelessness and folks who are on the street and some of whom may have multiple bench warrants, unpaid fines, and they're really at a point where they can't get out from under that mountain of debt and out from underneath the legal process that they have ahead of them. They're not bad folks. They just are in a position they can't move forward. So we offer them something called community outreach court, which allows them to do a community service and to work off the fines and also get services to hopefully move them off the street and into housing and homes. It was temporary over many years and has now been made permanent. So that's something we're really excited about. And I think we've gotten more funding for it as well. So that's also something we're excited about. Women's court and how we address the needs of women in the criminal justice system. I think we've learned that many, if not certainly most, women who come into the criminal justice system have had trauma earlier in their lives. And in order to move them on a path forward, you have to address that underlying trauma. That's something we've learned in what we call girls' court, which Judge Karen Radius founded out in Kapolei 20 years ago. And we decided 3 years ago with the legislature's approval to start that as a pilot project for adult women. And that's something that Judge Trish Morikawa has led. She's done a great job. We're getting great results in that court. And the legislature made that permanent, which is very exciting, and also expanded it to the Big Island on a pilot basis. So those are examples of programs that we've been working for a long time in partnership with the legislature, in partnership sometimes with the administration or city and county, to try to address really deep-rooted issues. We can't solve those problems all by ourselves, but we have ways in which we can help and help the community move forward.
It's interesting, too, that a lot of these outreach and diversion programs have expanded so much in this one legislative session. You've been Chief Justice for more than a decade now. You know, how have you seen the judiciary and the legislature change its thinking around the need for diversion programs?
Well, that's certainly been the case when you're talking about mentally ill people who come in contact with the criminal justice system. So that's something we've, again, worked on with the administration and the legislature, especially over the last 5 years or so. And what was happening is folks were getting picked up for relatively low-level offenses, presenting as mentally ill, and then being referred to the Hawaii State Hospital for evaluation and then for what's called restoration of competency. So basically being made competent to come back to district court to face a misdemeanor charge and typically have that charge either dismissed or then get a sentence of time served, go back on the street without any services, and basically all that effort that had gone into stabilizing them basically kind of just dissipating because there's no follow-up, there's no real emphasis on trying to help them move forward. So we've really worked hard with the administration and with the public defender and prosecuting attorneys offices to try to divert low-level folks, nonviolent people, out of custody and into treatment when they're presenting as mentally ill.
Another issue has been the recruitment for vacant judge positions, but judges will be getting raises over the next couple of years. So how much of an impact will that have on getting more people interested in becoming a judge?
Well, we're very grateful that the Salary Commission recommended salary increases for judges going forward and that the legislature allow those raises to become law because we've seen fewer and fewer people applying to become judges and longer delays for our Judicial Selection Commission to be able to identify and recommend candidates. So we've had, especially on the neighbor islands, frequently the commission will have to reopen a position to have try to get more people to apply. There's a minimum number of folks that it has to recommend for a particular position, like four. And sometimes they don't get four, or the four that they get are folks that they're just not comfortable pushing forward to either the governor or me. So, you know, just one case in point, my own position, which is the top position in the judiciary, the commission's had to reopen that position to hopefully allow more people to apply. So, you know, again, the data was there to show that there are significant, we're not getting as many folks and qualified folks as we'd hoped to apply for these positions. So salary was one important part of that. Another important part of it is security, and that's something we're always very aware of. And we had a significant bill two sessions ago that allows judges to have personal information removed from the internet, which is important to, I guess, protect them and their families from having folks maybe come to their homes to express discontent or worse. And those are all things that are part of the mix.
The judiciary is getting two new judge positions, one on Oahu and one on West Hawaii Island. What's the impact of that in those areas?
Well, especially, you know, in Kona, I think it's been almost 40 years since we added another judge. We basically have one district court judge for the west side of Hawaii Island. I think their numbers indicated something like 16,000 cases, which when you think about it, it's just that's a whole lot of cases for one judge to adjudicate the course of a year. And we have times there, you know, a busy morning calendar, maybe on a Monday morning when you could have more than 100 people showing up for court. And that's to get through that calendar and give everybody their day in court by allowing them to present what they want to present to the court. It's very, very difficult. It causes people to have to wait a long period of time before their cases are heard. And so clearly it was a situation that needed to be addressed. So we were very, very grateful to get that additional position there. And then here on Oahu, again, same sort of the same thing. We hadn't had an additional district court judge for almost 40 years. And, you know, again, our population has increased dramatically during that period of time. We are going to open a new courthouse in Wahiawa next year. And that's one thought, is that we'll have more resources to put into that courthouse and provide better services to folks on the sort of rural Oahu communities or central Oahu, up to the North Shore and out to West Oahu. And so I think this judge will help us be able to do even more of that and have more capacity for there, as well as for some of the programs we've talked about in terms of being able to go out into the community and help with folks who are, you know, basically living on the street.
You're finishing your post as Chief Justice later this year. You're ending your last legislative session on a really high note. But, you know, what are some issues that are still outstanding, and what are some of the things that you'd want to see your successor tackle?
Well, I mean, you know, access to justice and increasing access to our civil courtrooms for folks who can't afford a lawyer has been a huge priority for me and for the judiciary throughout my tenure. And I would hope and expect that my successor would build on those efforts, find new ways to be able to help people who can't afford a lawyer to be able to get representation or get the kind of get advice or information that will empower them to be able to effectively represent themselves. So that's been a huge effort, and we've made a lot of progress around the state. I think that the progress we made helped us more effectively respond to the fires in Lahaina, because we had members of the access to justice community, legal services providers, Maui County Bar Association, were able to jump in and get lawyers out on the ground in Lahaina relatively quickly and get folks who could help with issues ranging from immigration to landlord-tenant issues, a lot of family law issues, that we're able to get people on the ground helping in that community. And that's because we had already established relationships among all the different participants who could bring resources to the table. So I think the effort to expand access to justice has really been essential to delivering on the promise of justice for all. So I would hope my successor would focus on that. And the other area I think would be very important is to reach out and engage the community through going out and holding court sessions around the state, which is something we began doing at the Supreme Court back in 2012. So twice a year we go out, typically to a high school on the neighbor islands or on Oahu, hold an oral argument in an actual case and have students from that area, sometimes up to 500 students, come and watch the argument and then participate in a Q&A session with the court afterwards, as well as with the lawyers. It's a great way for the students to understand or actually see our court in action and understand a little better what the rule of law means. I could talk to them about it for an entire morning and it wouldn't necessarily resonate, but watching it in practice, I think, really is something that makes them feel empowered because they learn about the case before we get to campus. Lawyers in the community go out and talk to them about the case, give them a chance to do practice arguments themselves. So when we're up there asking questions, sometimes students have asked the same questions in their practice arguments, and that's incredibly empowering to them. And I think for some of them, they look at it and they think, wow, I could do that. And for others, I think hopefully they come away with the message it's a system that has integrity, that we try to get to the truth and we try to get to the correct outcome by diving deep into the issues and trying to figure out what the actual truth is and how the law should be applied to the facts of that case.
And when you retire in September, what's next for you?
You know, I'm really not sure. There's a lot of work to get done here in the next 4 months. So I'm kind of just, you know, really want to finish strong. And so especially I'm turning some of my attention now to wrapping up cases that we have pending that I'm involved in. And also just be able to go out and say thank you to people and for all the support they've given us during the time I've been here. Encourage people to stay involved. And frankly, we have a number of new judges coming in. So it's very exciting to see this new group of judges coming in. And they're going to do a great job of leading our state forward.
State Supreme Court Chief Justice Mark Rechtenwald speaking with HPR's Ashley Mizuo. A search for his judicial replacement is currently underway. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We go now to this week's Manu Minute. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to the Aku'u, and thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology for today's recordings.
The Aku'u, or black-crowned night heron, is the only heron that's common across the Hawaiian Islands that's an indigenous species, meaning that it's native here as well as other parts of the world. As their name implies, these herons have black crowns that run down their backs with light gray undersides, yellow legs, and piercing red eyes. Juveniles, though, look different from adults. They're mostly brown with light speckling. Aku'u can be found near most shallow, fresh, and saltwater areas where they feed on a variety of small aquatic animals like fish and frogs, and sometimes even mice and baby birds. When aku'u are standing still, they often have a hunchback appearance, but their long neck becomes apparent when they walk. These graceful, broad-winged water birds can often be seen in flight in the mornings and evenings, which is also the best time to hear their loud, hoarse call. Black-crowned night herons are excellent at fishing and are even known to use pieces of bread or other objects to lure in fish with the bait, an unusual form of tool use in birds. Aku'u are one of the many birds mentioned in the Kumulipo, or Hawaiian creation chant. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Biology Department at UH Hilo.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, offering nature tours on Hawaii Island with adventures including swimming in private waterfalls, Mauna Kea stargazing, and exploring active volcanoes. More at hawaii-forest.com.
Ooh, what a beautiful day this is. Ooh, little bird up in a tree.
It's been a week now since the family of the Beach Boys' Brian Wilson announced his death at the age of 82. By this point, you've no doubt read and heard many tributes to this remarkable musician, producer, and arranger, not only the force behind the Beach Boys, but also musical influence on more than a generation. Also the father of two-thirds of the 1990s music group Wilson Phillips. But we guarantee you have not heard anything like what you're about to hear from HPR's Dave Lawrence. This Friday on All Things Considered, you'll hear a compilation of highlights from three interviews Dave did with Brian Wilson over a span of nearly 10 years. And this morning on The Conversation, we wanted to give you a little preview, talk to Dave a little bit about the interviews and the experience. We're going to start with a project Brian Wilson did involving the music of George and Ira Gershwin, and it begins with his connection with and inspiration from a very special piece of music.
When I was 4 years old, my grandmother had a copy of Rhapsody in Blue by George Gershwin.
Mm-hmm.
So my mother took me over to her house, and they laid me down by her record player, and I listened to Rhapsody in Blue. Now, at that time, I can't remember listening at that time, but when I was 28 years old, I took Leonard Bernstein's version of Rhapsody in Blue, and I studied it until I learned, you know, the part that goes, da-da-da-da, that section?
Yep.
The pretty part of it? I learned how to play that on the piano. It took me about 2 weeks to learn it. And then after I learned it, then I remembered hearing it when I was 4 years old.
Kind of brought you back to the first time.
Oh, took me back to when I was just a little kid.
So what was it? The melody?
Well, not just the melody, but the way he constructed his harmonies were kind of special. He used to make harmonies like no other music maker could ever do. He was just a superior music man.
It was the hooks that drew you to that music.
Yeah. The hook, you mean the do-do-do-do, yeah. That's the part that blew me up the most, yeah.
What was it that ended up making these songs the ones that came onto the record?
Okay, here's what happened. First of all, they presented us with 25 George and Ira songs. And they wanted us to dwindle it down to just 12 songs. So we took our favorites, and we had our list of 12 songs to do. Then the Disney people got a hold of 104 unfinished Gershwin piano trips.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened was they said, I want you to take that 104 and listen to all of them and then choose just two out of the 104 that you can make a song around that will inspire a song. So we did just that. We listened to 100, it took us about a week, but we finally drilled it down to two, which eventually became The Like and I Love You and Nothing But Love. And those turned out to be very good songs, inspired by the melody and the chords of those two songs.
When you got them, first of all, what were they, on a CD?
Right. The Gershwin people gave it to the Disney people. The Disney people gave it to us.
And it was unfinished actual piano pieces.
By the man himself.
Unbelievable. That had to be just getting that. I'm just thinking out loud, that part of the project alone was very special.
Oh, yeah. It was one hell of a heck of a thrill for me to work with George. You know, I really was. I thought it was quite a moment in my life.
Brian Wilson talking with Dave Lawrence back in 2010 about a project reimagining some Gershwin by way of the Beach Boys. And Dave, you just feel the depth of that love for the music and appreciation.
Yeah, and what it must have been like for him to get a CD with a bunch of little sound clips of this actual dude playing and to be able to make a couple of jams, but based on these, just to sit with the CD and kind of, even if they're short clips, just keep rewinding and be like, wow, that's him.
and hearing him talk about working with his work with George,
yeah.
Working with George on that, that's great. You know, and also just talking about that and hearing the master of harmonies, when you talked with him about that, he also really gave you an insight about how he worked, talking about harmonies, not just the music, but in general with Beach Boys songs, the famous harmonies and weavings of sound, including one of their most famous pieces. Here's Brian Wilson again talking with Dave Lawrence in 2010.
Here's what we do. We don't do it. We quadruple. We do four overdubs for each four parts. So that's 16 voices.
And it's 16 tracks of you.
Yeah, it's like a little choir.
When I hear songs like, and you'll tell me if I'm right or wrong, but when I hear I've Got a Crush on You or I Got Rhythm, in my head, I see this Brian Wilson high school quarterback standing around the drive-in burger place, and the song just fits into your own life autobiographically.
Wow, that's amazing. I think that's fantastic. It's a great observation.
Is that accurate?
Yes, it is.
The making of Good Vibrations, which has been seen as not only a production extravaganza, but really it has a lot more to it. The theremin is used. What was it that was, you know, if you could just give me a little bit of the insight that came to that genius song?
Well, believe it or not, my brother Carl said, why don't we use a cello and a theremin? And I said, what? He goes, in the I'm picking up, good. And then he goes, why don't we call a theremin player and a cello player from the union and have them come down to the studio and work with us? So that's what we did, and they wound up being a really good part of the signature of Good Vibrations.
Not just is it a production piece, but the other thing I just wanted to hear if you would talk about a little bit, and it's really a part of you and your music and really your what you do for your fans. A couple people, when I told them I'd be speaking to you, they all commented about the love you've brought them through your music. And when you think about that song, Good Vibrations, I'm just wondering if you realized, aside from the song's geniusness as a produced song, just the good nature of those two words put together.
Well, Michael's idea to come up with I'm picking up good vibrations. I wrote a piano course that went bom 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 bom, and he took that melody bom bom and turned it into I'm picking up good vibrations. It was quite a coincidence that he could actually do that.
And what a message, though, that it carries to this day. It's like
the message is I'm picking up good vibrations. It's not with his brain or with his soul. He's picking up good vibrations from a place.
Good Vibrations from a Place. And, of course, Brian Wilson, very popular here, the Beach Boys here in Hawaii. Talk about sense of place. Just wanted to play one more short clip from that interview. When you two said goodbye, he sounded very glad to have talked with you.
Hey, Dave, you know, thank you so much for this interview. I don't know if I'll see you or not, and if we come to Hawaii, I'll have my publicist give me your number, and I'll call you when I get there, if I go to Hawaii.
You are the man. Brian, I'm giving you a big hug, and I really do appreciate your time, brother.
Man, you are something else of an interviewer. Thank you so much for a great interview. I've had thousands of interviews that ranged in the top five.
The late Brian Wilson, talking with Dave Lawrence with quite the compliment in 2010. You can hear more of that interview, also a couple of others, plus a great music medley, and a story about Brian Wilson meeting Chuck Berry on a flight to Kona. All this Friday afternoon on All Things Considered. Look for it around 5:45 on Friday. Dave, thanks for coming in on the conversation today and sharing some of your work and your memories.
Oh, mahalo for having me.
Dave Lawrence reflecting on his interviews with the Beach Boys' Brian Wilson. As we said, Dave will have a special remembrance of Wilson on All Things Considered. You can tune in this Friday afternoon right here on HBR One.
I love the colorful clothes she wears and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. I hear the sound of a gentle word on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air.
That is the program for today. Up tomorrow, we're airing a special broadcast to mark Juneteenth. The conversation will be back on Friday with Ahana Ho, highlighting local businesses that have made a name for themselves over decades and even centuries. You can leave your feedback on our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our archive shows online. Search for The Conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our own website, hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Bill Dorman. Join us Friday for more of The Conversation.
In her eyes, she goes with me to a blossom room.